Another sensational headline circulates online about the latest health risks or miracle cures. Your friends and patients are asking you, the physician, about it. So how do you spot the statistical manipulations and communicate them effectively? Find out today. We've got Dr. Nini Munoz of NiniInTheBrain.com. She is a PhD-trained engineer who rose to prominence during the COVID-19 pandemic by breaking down complex clinical data and exposing statistical manipulations on her platform, Nini in the Brain. With a background in risk assessment and data analysis, she's become a trusted voice for making science accessible and accurate in both English and Spanish. First, a word from our sponsors. Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Doctors change lives every day, but what happens when life changes yours? A single injury, a sudden illness, your career, your income, your future can shift in an instant. The best physicians don't just plan for success, they protect it. At Set for Life Insurance, they believe financial security isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. True own occupation disability insurance ensures that no matter what happens, your future stays in your hands. Because protecting your income means protecting everything you've built. Visit drpodcastnetwork.co/setforlife today. Secure your future before life makes that choice for you.
Thanks for having me.
So you have built this large following online where you break down science and statistics to make it easier for the lay public to understand. Right. But that's not what you do for a living. That's not what you do professionally. So take us back to the moment where you decided to really lean into this and spend your free time working on this.
I think it was around like the time of the COVID pandemic when we first started to see that large dramatic increase in case rates. And I think everybody was just locked at home. And I was getting a lot of questions from my peers, people back home in Colombia, asking what was going on, how do we interpret this study? Because as you recall, every single day there was a new headline that was being taken out of context. I remember one of the very first ones was that your blood type determined your COVID-19 outcome. I'm not sure if you recall that
yes.
one.
Like oh, yeah.
You were type A.
People still use that. People are like, no, I'm AB positive. I don't need to worry about COVID or whatever
right?
it was.
And I recall looking at this and I was like, wow, like, this is really terrible. Like most individuals don't have a really good understanding of how to interpret this data or what it means in their lives. What are the clinical implications? Now, when I first started doing this work, I didn't recognize what angle I was going to take early on. My background is more in data science and electrical engineering. So that was, of course, my strong suit, explaining statistics and statistical literacy and data literacy. But I didn't really discern that at the very beginning. At the very beginning, I was just trying to get through explaining whatever was being published every day.
Right? Until the next one came out. Right. Yeah.
Until the next one. And in order to do that, I was teaming up with other individuals who had backgrounds in virology, immunology. We created a huge community, a huge network, and we are friends, which is a positive outcome from all that. Now, what became really interesting, and I always think that what played in my favor was the fact that I was not an immunologist, was not a virologist, was not a clinician. What played in my favor was that I was an engineer. And people sometimes wonder why. In engineering, we have a very systematic way of quantifying risk. Like we actually have something called the risk priority number where we calculate your risk, like a number, right? It's the probability that it will occur, right, times the detection factor, times how severe the outcome will be. So what was really interesting about where I found myself in, the position I found myself in, is that I understood from very early on that the way that I was going to tackle this was not so much from the immunology or the virology. It was going to be from the fact that I knew that there was a clear distinction between risk and safety. And I talk about this often.
Yeah.
Risk we can quantify, But how many people have you not encountered that say, oh, I don't want to fly, even though it's statistically the safest mode of transportation? And what they're expressing there is feelings of safety, which are very different than the actual quantifiable risk.
Yeah.
So when I started doing this, when I really started to understand how I could refine my messaging, I started to realize I'm not going to talk to a person about why they need to get a COVID vaccine, perhaps to protect a person they don't know. But I'm going to explain it to them in a way they can relate to it. So, for instance, a young, healthy male may not think that they need a COVID vaccine until they understand how that plays a role in their access to healthcare, where they get in an accident on their bike. Like, how does that contribute? So now if you contribute to more disease in your community and your hospitals are overwhelmed and you go out for that bike ride and you have a traumatic brain injury, God forbid, now you may not have medical attention that you require. Now you may be prone to a secondary infection at a hospital. And that proved to be really effective.
That's really interesting.
And that's why I...
How do I make this really about me?
Exactly.
I'm not worried about protecting my community. I need you to talk to me about how you're going to protect me. But that's really interesting because we need to recognize that and then we can alter our message accordingly.
You need to intersect people's perception of risk and their values. You need to meet them where they're at.
Yeah.
And it sometimes, I think for many of us that are into public health protections and we do it because we want to protect our community, sometimes that's a little bit of a tough pill to swallow, to come to that realization, which is really incongruent with how we view the world. We view the world as we should all be doing good, right? We should all want the common good, but not everybody views the world that way.
But I think it's something we all have in common, right? There are some people who are interested in protecting their community and themselves, but everyone ultimately is interested in protecting themselves as well. So it would be a good default way to communicate when you're assuming, look at it in terms of themselves and how it might impact them. And then if they lead you on and want to know how it can help other people as well, then you can follow them in that direction. But I think it makes sense to just default to that. How does this impact you? So you mentioned risk, and something that you've recently discussed is the difference between risk and hazard. And I don't quite understand what the difference is between those two.
So a hazard is anything that can cause harm. By that definition, water is a hazard. Right. If you, we think about it, if you drink too much water, you can get hyponatremia.
Yes.
And risk is how likely is it that can cause harm? And that's why context really matters. So water in itself is a hazard, right? Or you can jump into a body of water, right? But if you know how to swim, there is less risk to you, right?
Yeah.
As I said, technically anything is a hazard. Anything could potentially cause harm. Seatbelt can cause harm. It's a rare instance, a rare occurrence, but it's been documented. Whereas risk is how we quantify the likelihood of that causing harm. And it's very context specific. So yes, water is a hazard, but I can drink water in normal quantities and be okay. Now, if I subject myself to drinking, I don't know, depends on my kidney function, right? If I subject myself to drinking 2-3 liters of water in an hour, and under an hour, now I may be subjecting myself to like water poisoning, right? Reduced sodium blood levels. And risk is now a function of like exposure, dose, context. In some instances, like the example of the body of water and the swimmer and ability, the risk for a person who doesn't know how to swim is vastly different than a person who's an expert swimmer.
So the hazard is the thing that might harm you and how it might harm you. And the risk is the likelihood of that happening.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So the purpose of today's discussion was to get into the common tricks that the media uses to manipulate data, and also ne'er-do-wells to manipulate data, so that we, the physicians, can spot them easily and then help our patients and our communities navigate that. So actually, one I wanted to start with is base rate fallacy, right? Which has been used recently in raw milk. So I think all the physician listening believe in pasteurization, Personally, something I replied to one of your Instagram posts was, I think we should be rebranding pasteurized milk as clean milk, right? Marketing matters. Marketing
matters. That's great.
Right? Clean milk. Okay. So pasteurized milk is clean milk as opposed to, and then the raw milk is now dirty milk. But what they're saying is more people are hospitalized and die from pasteurized milk than raw milk. So how is this a statistical manipulation?
Well, those are absolute numbers, and it makes sense because 97% of the population drinks pasteurized products, right? And so if you now adjust for the number of individuals that consume pasteurized versus unpasteurized products, which is the base rate, if you now adjust for those numbers, you get a rate. So in order to properly make a comparison between groups that drink pasteurized versus groups that drink unpasteurized pasteurized products, you need to divide by the population. Otherwise, you're just comparing absolute numbers.
We're missing a denominator. You got to throw the denominator in, and suddenly risk becomes dramatically different because those percents are dramatically different.
It's like the seatbelt. So 50% of fatalities result in individuals that were wearing a seatbelt, passenger, right? Passenger occupants. But 90% of the population wears their seatbelt. So now if you adjust for the fact that there are almost 10 times as many individuals wearing their seatbelt versus not, you adjust for the denominator, you find that you're 10 times less likely to die when being ejected if you're wearing your seatbelt versus not.
And there's probably a survivorship bias because of the people who are, I'm not sure if that's the correct bias, let me know. But people who drive without seatbelts are probably more reckless drivers than people who drive with seatbelts. So they're more likely to get in accidents to begin with as well. That might
be scary. Then you get into what we call, I think, more like a healthy user bias, which is something that you really do encounter in a lot of studies that report an effect. And in reality, it's a healthy user bias that you're encountering. I think this was part of the Women's Health Initiative, like those first landmark studies around hormones. I believe that was one of the major confounders, which really skewed that initial perception that really scared many women from hormone replacement therapy, that there was a healthy user bias as well, that skewed results. So that's something to watch out for. Sometimes the people that are in the intervention arm already have healthier habits.
Like vitamins don't make you healthy, but people who take vitamins tend to be healthier because they're doing things like taking vitamins.
They're doing other things, right? Yeah. So it's not necessarily the vitamins, but they most likely than not have a healthier diet. They most likely than not exercise and have better health-seeking behaviors. They might be individuals who are more likely to see their doctors and follow up with their physicians. And we know the importance of having access and seeing your doctor and preventing certain conditions from worsening over time or even just detection. So it's vastly important to always adjust for that healthy user bias, especially around things that you encounter online when you see, oh, these interventions are working. Well, are they working? Or is it any of the other behaviors that have been adopted in tandem with that intervention that are responsible for the effect? That's why you really need to have controlled studies at all times when you are looking at two interventions, because otherwise it may be a healthy user bias, which is another way of saying there are confounders, right? There are other things at play here that could be impacting that outcome that have nothing to do with the intervention per se.
So is there anything else that's been in the media lately that would be a good example of how statistics can be manipulated?
Oh, every day. So things that come to mind, one of the more basic ones is the absolute versus relative risk. So there are times where it's appropriate, there's times where it's not appropriate. So sometimes you'll hear something like, this increases your chances of getting sick by 300%. But when you take a look at the absolute numbers, they're very marginal, right? So you may be going from a 1 per 100,000 to a 3 per 100,000 or something like that. So it's still considered rare. So that definitely gets taken out of context a lot.
Yeah.
By the same token, sometimes the opposite is done. So there were times during the peak of the COVID pandemic where people wanted to downplay how well vaccines were working, and they would argue the absolute numbers are small. They would report the absolute number. So they would say, this is only decreasing your chances of infection from 7.1 per 10,000 to 5.1 or 4.1. So if you report it like that, it sounds like it's not having much of an effect, except that with vaccines, because it's infectious and there's a downstream ramification, it's more appropriate to use relative risk.
Yeah.
Because the absolute risk does not capture the downstream implications.
But now we're talking about other people again, because you're talking about not as it's not helping that person, but it's decreasing the spread. I don't remember the term that we use for how transmissible a virus is, but it's like the difference between one that spreads at a rate of 1 to 1 versus 1 to 1.2, right?
Yeah.
After a few generations, that difference makes a huge difference in how many people
absolutely
end up getting
it's exponential.
It.
Yeah, it's exponential.
Yeah.
So that's one of the more common, but there are many. One of the most common ones that I see is when data is taken out of context to imply that something is working, when in reality, the data is lacking. And it happens through many avenues. One way it happens is when mechanistic data or data from animal studies gets extrapolated to the human population. We see this all the time. I'm always discussing this with fluoride studies, with RF radiation. The other way that data gets taken out of context is when there's a study that finds an effect. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a large effect. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a robust effect or a replicable one, for that matter.
Yeah.
But it's still reported as an effect. And I always tell people, look, there's a difference between whether something works versus how well it works. If I were to count every single hair strand on my head with AI, because that's the only way that I could do it, one day, and I get, I don't know what the density of hairs is outside of my niche of expertise, but let's say, I don't know, like 100,000 or a few thousand hairs.
Sure, 100,000, nice round number.
Let's say 100,000 per square inch. Let's say, just put in that number.
Yeah.
It's probably inaccurate, but let's just use that number. And the next day, I count 100,000 and one. Technically, that's something that works.
Yeah.
Technically, that has an effect, but it's 0.0001%. So it doesn't mean that it works well.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's very likely that it's within the error.
Yeah.
And it can't be replicated, but it works.
So I think we'd call that statistically significant versus clinically significant. You're never going to
exactly
start an intervention if you're going to get such small effect, because it just doesn't make sense to perform that intervention. So you mentioned fluoride, because fluoride's been in the news a lot lately. They're taking fluoride out of the water. And first, what is their argument for removing fluoride from the drinking water? And then let's use that as a jump off point for
statistical manipulation. So let me get started by saying that the argument moves all over the place. And the fact that the argument is shifting all over the place tells you that it's not about the argument.
Yeah.
It's not about the science. This is about a belief. That's like the first thing I want to lay clear.
Yes. So a shifting goalpost.
It's shifting goalpost. When the argument is consistent, then there's more reason to think, okay, let's look into this one thing. But the fact that the argument has shifted,
yeah,
and it's gone from everything from IQ to thyroid to BMI and now to gut microbiome changes, that in itself, when you change
although
your argument,
something
you
can have multiple ill
right
effects. Something can have multiple ill effects. It's possible.
But let's go back to fluoride, right?
Yeah.
So here's what's really interesting. The data is available, and I've reviewed a lot of it. It's subject to many limitations. The two biggest limitations I see is that first, some of the levels of fluoride that are explored in these studies are extremely high, past beyond the levels of consumption. And there is a big confounder, which is socioeconomic status, right? And you see this in some of these studies where maybe we see a change in BMI, but then parental education or parental socioeconomic. So there's a big confounder. Is it that
yes
in areas where there is more naturally occurring fluoride or higher fluoride exposure? Because a lot of it is that these are areas of naturally more occurring fluoride in the water.
Oh, interesting. It
could be areas where there are more poverty levels. So that's a big confounder. And as I said, one of the biggest limitations is that a lot of the data that is being taken a look at, the subjects are exposed to higher levels of fluoride than what we regularly consume. The medians here in the U.S. range from like 0.6 to 0.87 milligram per liter according to the latest EPA documentation. So it's nowhere near these values that you see in the literature, which are above 2 mg/L, right, as far as fluoride. So that's one of the biggest confounders. The other thing that happens with, there's a long list, but the other bigger thing that I see with fluoride studies is that the effects are really weak and inconsistent. And I always tell people, look, when you have an effect that is weak and inconsistent, you really have to question it, especially because we have a publication bias problem. And what that means is that the papers that find an effect are more likely to get published. So you're not seeing half of the literature, even if you do a meta-analysis where you have all these papers that have some effect or some marginal effect, half of the literature is probably missing because those studies are less likely to get published. So when you see this data that's weak and inconsistent, that's a big problem in academia, right? The publisher perish culture of academia.
Yeah. But if you do a well-executed study, and I'm not an academic, right? Yeah. I pipetted for a couple of months in residency and that was it. But if you find that there's no relationship, isn't that still publishable?
Yeah, it is publishable and it does get published. It just doesn't get published to the same extent as the ones that have an effect. So they do get published, but it just skews, even imagine that you're doing a meta-analysis where you're pulling from the literature, it's going to skew your meta-analysis.
Yeah.
But more important than that, once you dig into these studies, there's so many red flags. First, urinary fluoride, which is not a good measure of long-term exposure for fluoride. The second thing that you observe, you see U-shaped distributions. If the underlying premise is that fluoride is a neurotoxin, we're thinking about IQ, right? IQ effects. Why are you observing the effects at low doses but not at higher doses? So whenever I see a U-shaped curve in the literature, I'm always like, huh? Remember, I did a post on wine consumption. The initial studies on consumption of wine showed that wine was protective. The first bit of the literature. Remember when we got the advice of, one glass of wine is
red,
good for you.
And red wine is better than white wine. Yes.
Yes, because of the polyphenols. There's so many arguments for it, right? That red wine was better for you. It turns out that was a U-shaped effect, right? Where you saw no wine, moderate wine, large amounts of consumption, and then you saw benefit for those in the moderate category. But once you weeded out the people that had quit drinking because they got sick, you actually saw a completely different relationship. That no amount of alcohol is considered safe. So I'm always very skeptical when I see J or U-shaped curves in response as
an exposure or an intervention. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's a lot of what you see in this fluoride. So that actually does not reflect anything consistent with causal effect, but more that there's a confounding variable. So that's one of the many other things that I encounter with these. I'm actually preparing a piece on this, not using fluoride. I'm going to use another example to show people what are the problems. And then the other thing that ends up happening is because when you take a look at the actual data, the distribution of fluoride consumption is not homogeneous. So what you see is you see a cluster of data points around the central tendency, right, the mean, and then you see these outliers, and those really drag the average down. So it really creates the appearance of a trend, even though there isn't one. And so if you don't have homogeneous exposure of fluoride, then your trend is just not really consistent. It's less reliable because it's the same as if though I was, perfect example of this. Imagine that you measure the height of a population and in your town, you get two different results. In one group, you get that everybody is roughly 5'8", right? Plus or minus an inch. What if you have another group where half of the individuals are, I don't know, let's say 5 feet, and half of the individuals are, 6'4", something like that, right? 6'4", 6'6". Two clusters.
Yeah.
Which one do you think is more representative of your population? They have the same average.
Yeah.
Right? Technically, those two different groups would have the same average. But one of them is showing you two extremes. The other one is showing you a more homogenous distribution of what the population actually looks like.
And so what you're saying is if one of the studies is everybody's 5'8", that's going to be more reliable than if there's these two different extremes where they're getting lots of different values. There's got to be some confounding,
which is what you're seeing with these,
some confounding variables in there that aren't being accounted for. And
exactly. And you see this with the fluoride literature, because you'll see either groups that are exposed to high levels of fluoride and then groups that are exposed to baseline levels of fluoride. Or sometimes there was a study that I recently dissected, which was exploring the relationship between maternal fluoride consumption during pregnancy and offspring IQ. And what you saw is that most of the children's IQ was right around where it should have been, the ballpark. It was fine. And then there were a few outliers that had an IQ of 70, which is now likely more analogous with some type of intellectual disability. So that was an outlier. But guess what? It skewed the trend down.
Yeah.
And so when you parse the data, you saw that there was a negative effect for boys and a positive effect for girls. So somehow girls got smarter with more fluoride consumption, which again, this goes to show that's not a real effect.
Yeah.
That's residual confounding or another confound or data parsing and proper data binning that's creating these effects. And if there's one thing that's consistent across fluoride studies is that they're weak and inconsistent, in my opinion. And this is just an example of the many things that I see in the fluoride literature.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Ending Physician Overwhelm. This was one of my most popular guests from 2024, and for me, one of the most impactful episodes. We all feel overwhelmed by the demands of medicine. So Ending Physician Overwhelm by Dr. Megan Mello offers strategies to reclaim balance and joy in your life. Take the first step towards well-being. Listen and subscribe today. So we have a little more time left. Is there one more thing in the news that you want to use an example, or any other tricks that are used that will help our statistical literacy?
I think there's quite a bit of it. We've spoken a lot about the clinical significance versus statistical significance. I think in general, what I always encourage people to do is look at the larger body of evidence and weigh what you're seeing against that. Now, I can totally see how in some areas it could be a bit contentious, right? Like a lot of data on one end and a lot of data on the other end. And that's where it gets a little bit trickier. But I think in addition to looking at the large body of evidence, when you have those instances where you encounter conflicting information and you think that there is sufficient, it's really important to learn how to ask the right questions about the data. You don't need to know everything, but learning how to ask the right questions. And my favorite questions, we've covered most of them here, right? How well does it work versus whether it works? How repeatable is it? That's a big one. If nobody can replicate your data set with the exact same procedures, that's very questionable. As well as what are the other confounders associated with the data? The sampling, right? Is this representative of the population, or is there a bias here that makes it more likely for one to observe or not observe an effect in the specific study? So those are things that I really encourage people to ask. Always ask questions and refer to people with expertise around those questions, because it's important to be curious, but it's also important to encounter that, or to make sure you collide that curiosity with humility, where you understand, okay, I don't know enough about this. And there's nothing wrong with not knowing. I think that if we can all be a little bit more humble, we'd be in a totally different place right now.
And I think for those people who end up falling down the rabbit hole and becoming the conspiracy theorists and the contrarians, I think the humility is ultimately where they're lacking, right? Like the Dr. Mehmet Oz's of the world, who has had to stand before Congress previously to answer for his constant spewing of misinformation. And right now he's in the administration. Super smart guy, right? Like CT surgeon, super accomplished.
Yeah, they're really smart.
But I think what makes you vulnerable is the lack of humility, the thinking that you can know all of these things, that you're not just not trained. I'm a smart guy. I can figure this stuff out. And it's the lack of humility that sends them down these paths where they think they can speak in an educated way. And we're seeing it over and over, right? Getting out of your lane and speaking and then end up repeating misinformation and then doubling down on it. And it keeps on
doubling down. Yeah. And believe it or not, one of the most humbling experiences of my life has been doing this work, because in learning how to communicate a lot of the science, I've learned how much I don't know. And one of the most rewarding aspects of the work that I've done is first, not just learning new things, because I've had to rely extensively on people in other areas of expertise, like immunologists and virologists and infectious disease researchers and even clinicians, things that are really outside of my own niche, right? Because I can speak more to the data, but then even within the weeds of the data, especially once you get to the clinical standpoint and you know this, right? There's population level data, and then there's the individual level risk assessment and approach.
Right. Where do you fall? Where does the individual patient in front of you fall within that population?
That's exactly, because you might have population data, but that's not going to tell you much about drug interactions and lifestyle. So I've had to learn how to navigate that. And that in itself has been really rewarding, learning new things and learning new ways of communicating. But even more rewarding has been learning to be okay with not knowing. That's something that I think, especially people that get MDs or get PhDs, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into that. And I think some of that is built into many of us, like this, oh, I worked so hard.
Yeah.
You've learned so much. But learning how to break down some of that and really understanding, I always understood that there was a lot that I didn't know. That I've always known. I think it's learning to be very happy and comfortable with it that I have now. Because before, I always felt there was a bit of a threat. I was like, oh my God, I don't know that. Like, I felt lesser then. Now I'm just like, oh, I don't know that. How cool. I can learn something new. And that mentality change is something that I really want to push on. Because that's in the field of engineering, we build things through trial and error. Yeah. Like, you take a look at the way things are done, and so you do something, it doesn't work. You do the next thing, it doesn't work. You do the next thing, it doesn't work. And those, that iterative sequence of events is what leads you to your end product.
Yeah.
Just as iterative failures is what I call it. Engineering is an iterative failure. But learning how to be comfortable with it publicly, nothing forces you to really be like, oh, wow, I really don't know that. And I'm just okay with that. And I'm not going to speak outside of my lane because I don't understand that. Yeah. Even though at times you're tempted to say something, right? You're like, oh, no, I'm not going to say that.
And this gets back to growing up. Like, growing up as someone who did academically, if something was hard for you, it meant that maybe you weren't as smart as you thought you were. And now being online amongst other experts and being asked questions of your peers and colleagues and being able to say, I have no idea. It's humbling, but there's some, I think, also freedom in that, right?
Oh, there's a lot of freedom. Once you embrace,
then you can just be like, I don't know, that's someone else. You got to give Nini a call. We'll find out from her. Let's find out. So it's humbling, but freeing at the same time.
It's so liberating. It's so liberating, even for your own self, right? You hold yourself to a different standard, and it's not a lower standard, because you can continue to learn things. That's the thing people have to understand. It doesn't mean you're lesser than. It's actually a way of you recognizing there's more to learn, and there's so much value and excitement around that.
Amazing. So if people want to follow you online, right? That's how I found you. Nini in the Brain on Instagram.
Nini
I love all the stuff that you put out there. But where else can people find you?
So I'm also on Substack. My Substack is called Teching It Apart. It's like tech, but taking it apart. So I discuss statistics and technology. And I'm also on Threads. And those are like the platforms that I manage. I very rarely have I posted on Blue Sky, although I will probably start being more present there in the next few months. But yeah, for the most part, I'm on Instagram and I have a website. And yeah, and I actually do quite a bit in as far as talking to clinicians about how to have these conversations with their patients around risk and risk-based approaches for communication. I will be doing quite a bit of that this summer for some branches of Kaiser permanent here in California. Because I really do think that nowadays we are doing risk communication, not just science communication. It's not about the data. It's how people feel about the data.
Yes. That's an excellent way to put it. An excellent way to end. So if you need a speaker for your next grand rounds, Dr. Nini Munoz, thank you so much for your time and all the great information you put out into the world.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it, or like it, or comment on a social media post, or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.